Welcome to The Week, the weekly news podcast from The Scientist. This edition of The Week is sponsored by Invitrogen. Gibco cell culture products now feature easy-to-read, color-coded, and writable labels that are easy to find. Take a closer look at www.invitrogen.com/labels. This week, two stories from The Scientist Daily News. One on why a journal is retracting a 1997 paper tied up with the case made famous by Aaron Brockovich. And another on prospects for U.S. stem cell funding. Also, senior editor Brendan Marr describes what happened when he tried to profile a tobacco company scientist. First, correspondent Melissa Lee Phillips reports that a journal is planning to retract a 1997 paper that is tied up with the case made famous by Aaron Brockovich. Editors at the Journal of Occupational and Environmental Medicine are planning to retract a 1997 paper that claimed no link between drinking water polluted with toxic chromium and cancer incidence. The decision comes after editors discovered that much of the paper was put together by consultants hired by a public utility that at the time was being sued for allegedly endangering California residents through chromium pollution. Paul Brandt Ralph, the journal's editor, told The Scientist that the retraction is based solely on failure to disclose financial and intellectual contributions by Pacific Gas and Electric, PG&E Corporation. He said, quote, "I was very careful in the wording of the retraction so that we have no evidence of scientific fraud," end quote. Brandt Ralph began investigating the paper after being alerted by both The Wall Street Journal and Environmental Working Group, a Washington, D.C.-based advocacy group, that the paper was actually compiled and written by employees of a consulting company called ChemRisk, rather than the Chinese physicians Jin Dongzhang and Shukun Li, who were also listed as sole authors. Says Brandt Ralph, "I gathered all the facts from both sides. There actually wasn't much disagreement that there was financial and intellectual input that was not acknowledged," end quote. Zhang is now deceased, but Brandt Ralph contacted Li through a translator who said Li had no objections to the retraction. ChemRisk's involvement began in the mid-1990s, when PG&E asked them to look into a 1987 article by Zhang that was published in a Chinese preventative medicine journal, according to Brent Kerger, who was a principal scientist with ChemRisk. The article reported that cancer rates were unusually high in five villages in northeastern China, where people were exposed to water contaminated with hexavalent chromium, also called chromium-6. At the time, PG&E was being sued by residents of Hinckley, California, in the case made famous in the movie Aaron Brockovich, for contaminating local water with chromium-6. Chromium-6 is a potent carcinogen when inhaled, but it's controversial whether it causes cancer when ingested through drinking water, said Renee Sharp, an analyst with an environmental working group. Kerger told The Scientist that Zhang's 1987 paper was, quote, "not enough to sway the scientific community that there was a meaningful oral cancer risk from chromium-6. We basically contacted Dr. Zhang to find out more about what his study meant," end quote. ChemRisk hired Zhang, who was retired, to work as a consultant for a stipend of $250 a month. He provided his original data and advice on how the study was done, says Kerger. ChemRisk scientists also wanted to be co-authors on the paper, according to Kerger, but Zhang preferred that only he and Li appear as authors. Says Kerger, quote, "he was fearful of there being any kind of political repercussions from him consulting with us," end quote. The subsequent reanalysis of Zhang's data by ChemRisk scientists showed no association between chromium exposure, as measured by the distance people lived from the source of pollution, and cancer rates. In fact, Zhang had never claimed such a link in his original paper, according to Kerger, but translations and summaries of his work in English had added that conclusion. Kerger noted that Zhang was angry that the scientific translation problem was that blatant, and that he wanted to have that work clarified. Kerger defends ChemRisk by saying, quote, "was the fact that we paid him a consulting fee an important contribution to this paper? Our judgment was no. Was our intellectual contribution significant in the light of the contributions of the authors that we wanted to have on the paper? The answer that we came to was no," end quote. Kerger states that the paper was just a summary and a clarification of this research that already existed. Renee Sharp of the Environmental Working Group disagrees, saying, quote, "they reversed their finding, very conveniently, of course, for PG&E, and there was no mention anywhere that ChemRisk was involved, that it was funded by PG&E, end quote. According to PG&E spokesman John Tremaine, quote, our role and the role of the consultants in this case should have been acknowledged when that study was submitted. Our own standards should have required that, end quote. The 1997 paper concluded that lifestyle or environmental factors not related to chromium-6 contamination were likely responsible for the cancer rates. It affected governmental policies implemented afterwards, Sharp said, especially in California. She said that the study, quote, forced the state to basically discard their risk assessment, which was based on the assumption that chromium did cause cancer, end quote. California is still working towards setting a regulation for chromium-6 in drinking water, she said. Next, Ted Agris finds out that prospects are murky for U.S. stem cell funding. Leading U.S. senators are hoping to remove political roadblocks and pass legislation allowing the National Institutes of Health and other agencies to make federal research funds available for newly derived human embryonic stem cells. Despite wide bipartisan support, however, their bill has been withheld from full Senate consideration due to a combination of election year politics and a promised veto by President Bush should it be passed into law. The legislation titled Stem Cell Research Enhancement Act of 2005 would expand federal research funding to human embryonic stem cell lines regardless of when they were derived. Current federal funding is limited to an approved list of stem cell lines that were derived before August 9, 2001, when Bush announced the policy. A version of the bill had already passed the House of Representatives in May 2005. Republican Senator Majority Leader Bill Frist, who surprised many of his conservative colleagues last July when he abruptly decided to support expanded stem cell research and promised to bring the controversial matter to the full Senate, has been working with Senators Orrin Hatch, Arlen Specter, and others to craft an election year compromise. The package of competing stem cell bills would give senators seeking re-election sufficient political cover with their constituents, yet hopefully bring resolution to the long simmering debate. Congressional sources and biomedical research policy analysts say. First spokesperson Carolyn Weforth told The Scientist, quote, the senator hopes to bring the bill to the floor before the end of the summer, but at this time there is no specific timeline. Senator Frist is working with his colleagues because of the significant scientific and ethical issues involved. Frist, Hatch, and other stem cell supporters are seeking to get a unanimous consent agreement from all 100 senators to bring at least three different competing stem cell bills to the floor for a series of up or down votes, according to Hatch spokesman Peter Carr. Votes would be held without debate or the possibility of inserting amendments, and each bill would require 60 votes to pass. Carr told The Scientist, quote, the bills included in that package are still quite unclear, but if we get it, it can be voted on without taking too much time, end quote. In addition on this bill, other bills under consideration include a measure by Kansas Senator Sam Brownback to criminalize human cloning and somatic cell nuclear transfer, or SCNT, of human embryos, a bill by Senators Hatch and Dianne Feinstein to outlaw human cloning but allow SCNT for research, and an alternative research bill by Senators Specter and Rick Santorum that would direct NIH to find ways of deriving human embryonic stem cells without destroying human embryos. Congressional sources and policy analysts say at least 60 senators are expected to support the Stem Cell Research Enhancement Act of 2005 to expand stem cell funding, enough to pass the bill, but probably not the two-thirds necessary to override a presidential veto. In the House, where the bill passed by 238 to 194 last year, an additional 52 votes would be needed for an override. Any legislation that fails to pass this year needs to be reintroduced next year. A truncated election year schedule further compounds matters. Congress plans to take a week off for the 4th of July and be out all of August. And if lawmakers follow the usual summer pattern for not voting on Mondays and Fridays, we're not talking about many legislative days left before the November elections, said David Moore, Senior Associate Vice President for Governmental Relations at the Association of American Medical Colleges, AAMC. Finally, Senior Editor Brendan Marr describes what happened when he tried to interview a tobacco company scientist.
Picture this, among the Cirque du Swag of the Bio 2006 exhibit hall in Chicago, a cheerful young scientist pads up to the booth of a certain magazine of the life sciences. On scanning her name tag, one of my colleagues notices an interesting affiliation, Philip Morris. Intrigued, He asks the senior research scientist about her work, which she says involves harm reduction. With 16,000 people in attendance, Bio is about as far away as you can get from the deserted parking garage that was the scene of a meeting between an investigative reporter and tobacco company research biologist Jeffrey Wigand, whistleblower played by Russell Crowe in the movie The Insider. It was enough to make us think that this perfectly pleasant woman was a sign that the company had turned over a new leaf, if you'll pardon the pun, towards transparency. The prospect of writing a profile on this scientist was intriguing, if only it were so. The following Monday, armed with this senior research scientist's willingly preferred card, I called her. Bubbly and sweet, she answered her own phone, saying that the prospect of an interview sounded interesting, although she'd been at the company only 6 months and might not be the best person to talk with. She said she'd get back to me. Tuesday morning, I had a message from one Greg Mathey inviting me to return his call. I'd have to answer some questions about the story we proposed before getting access to the scientist. When prodded, Mathey revealed that he works with the Public Affairs Office, but said, quote, "I'm not a spokesperson," end quote. This was apparently important, as it would be reiterated to me several times. Mathey told me nicely that they'd let me know either way, before deadline. Days passed, and while I understand the desire to vet a story, I couldn't imagine what was taking so long. So on Thursday, I called back to find out. Apparently, Mathey told me, they have to interview her and her superiors to determine if the interview was appropriate. Friday, my deadline, Mathey calls back to inform me that the researcher in question had declined. He couldn't offer a reason or another interview. She simply declined. When I asked for the spelling of his name, he repeated his earlier statement, "I'm not a spokesperson for the company." Soon I was getting calls from Jennifer Golish, an actual spokesperson for Philip Morris USA. Finally, the big leagues. I expected a slick Nick Naylor type, a la "Thank You for Smoking," gleaming with the polish of effectively deflecting 1,000 pointed reporter questions. What I got was quite different. Golish informed me that the researcher in question had written her an email saying that she did not wish to be interviewed and asking the media affairs group to let me know. "I have it in front of me," she said. "Something didn't sound right about that. When did she send that email to you?" I asked. The answer, Monday, April 17th, confirmed my suspicion. That was the day before I received a call from Mathey, and 4 days before he told me she'd declined. When I tried to get to the bottom of the song and dance they gave me about letting me know either way, Golish became unhinged and answered my questions with the following, quote, "What exactly, I mean, I'm just having a really hard time understanding exactly. See, it seems to me, so, you have, so, you're sort of looking for, I'm just not," she went on, unhinged. Finally, a semblance of an explanation, but the answer sure didn't reflect well on their handling of the situation. Golish said she thought the press office might have some interesting news to share with me about a proposed R&D center. That's apparently a good enough reason to hide details from me. And Golish wouldn't even tell me more about said technology center. I was left wondering, if this is how Philip Morris handles reporters who come in calling with a potentially positive story, what happens when folks are chasing down a less pleasant lead?
Join us online at www.the-scientist.com for more of the Scientist Daily News, blogs on current events, controversies and conferences, and features from our June print edition.
This edition of The Week was brought to you by Invitrogen. Gibco cell culture products now feature easy-to-read, color-coded, and writable labels that are easy to find. Take a closer look at www.invitrogen.com/labels.